Have you guys, by the way, watched any of these clips from C-SPAN? Actually, I never thought these words would pass my lips.
Of the house?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I've been watching the whole thing all week.
I mean, it's ruining my work life. I'm getting absolutely nothing else done. I keep refreshing.
There was that moment where AOC is in this, like, actually apparently substantive conversation with one Paul Gosar, who had already gotten in trouble for circulating an animated video about killing her. I mean, the whole thing. What it shows you, I actually think is kind of fascinating, because it does show you that there are layers of performance and reality that we all know are there, but we don't always get to see.
Well, the thing that also I was fixated on was the smile on McCarthy's face.
Totally agree.
Round after round after round goes down.
Humiliating.
You see this guy with this rictus
of humiliation.
The kicker of my column was, why the hell is this man smiling?
That's very funny.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Susan Glasser, and I'm joined by my colleagues Evan Osnos and Jay Mayer. Hey, guys.
Hey, Susan. Hey, Evan.
Hi there, guys. Good to see you in person.
It's been a long time. Happy New Year.
Likewise.
Yeah.
Madam Clerk, on behalf of the House Republican Conference, I rise today to nominate the gentleman from California, Kevin McCarthy, as Speaker of the House to lead America's new Republican majority.
No person having received the majority of the whole number of votes cast by surname, a Speaker has not been elected.
Rising to nominate Byron Donalds for Speaker.
Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House.
Congressman Byron Donalds.
Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the People's House.
Florida, Mr. Donalds.
The gentleman is
rise to nominate Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House.
I rise to place in nomination the name of Byron Donalds of Florida.
Kevin McCarthy for Speaker of the
Byron
House.
Byron Donalds.
Well, it's Groundhog Day. Again.
A Speaker has not been elected. Wow. By Thursday evening, Kevin McCarthy, the aspiring Speaker, had lost 11 straight votes to become the next Speaker of the House. And until the question is resolved, nothing can happen in the House of Representatives. And I mean nothing. No new legislation, no top secret briefings, even no paychecks, unless, that is, they get it wrapped up in the next few days. One branch of the U.S. government is essentially in purgatory. Now, who knows what will happen to McCarthy? Is he just a victim of his own efforts to appease a group of dissenters again and again and again? Can anyone become in charge of this fractious and very small Republican majority? Either way, this entire episode, it seems to me, is instructive about the current state of the Republican Party on Capitol Hill. From who wields the true power to what the next 2 years of divided government in Washington might look like. So, Jane and Evan, we're obviously talking on Friday morning. We don't know yet what, if any, deals have been cut or whether they'll even matter. What will happen today? We'll see. But I want to know, how have you both taken in the last few days of absolute chaos? What a mayhem-filled start to the year, isn't it, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, I've taken it in like a kind of embarrassed addict. I mean, I kind of can't stop watching this stuff, partly because in some ways it's like the drama that exposes all of these abstract theoretical things that we all talk a lot about the dysfunction of Washington. But here it is now playing out in this uniquely kind of human and quite alarming way. And I think it's entertaining, but as we'll talk about today, I think the implications are actually deeply worrying. And I know all of us are thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I was sort of laughing and almost at it in the beginning. It was a farce, and it's becoming kind of a tragedy. Hmm. I mean, it is becoming a serious disgrace. And I was walking through Washington yesterday on the Mall and looked up at the Capitol, and you can't feel any respect for what's happening at this point. And I think that's probably how the rest of the world's looking at this, too.
Well, you know, this is a kind of crisis that happens so rarely because it's really generally a story about parties that are breaking up when it happens. And that's the story of the last big crisis like this in 1923, was a huge rift inside the Republican Party. And it's definitely the story of the crisis-filled 1856 election, 133 ballots, 2 months it took. That was the end of the Whig Party and, the beginning of the prelude to the Civil War. Let's hope we're not there yet. But, you know, certainly it's also a story about the modern GOP today. So let's talk about Kevin McCarthy, because in the end, it is the story about one man and his ambition, right? He has tried and failed before to become the Speaker of the House after John Boehner left in 2015. He didn't get there. In the last few years, he's made a number of concessions again and again and again and again. And that's the story that we have here. This group of what is calling themselves the Never Kevins has emerged. So let's talk about that, Evan. Kevin McCarthy seems very focused on the Never Kevins, far more so than on the 200 Republicans who stuck with him. Is there any concession that he can make to them other than bowing out himself that would end this impasse?
What we don't yet know is, of course, whether he's going to land this plane. What we already know is that even if he does, he is going into it wounded. He has essentially cut off his legislative arms and legs and is left with very little power. I mean, he's already being described as perhaps the weakest speaker in modern times. Why? And it's worth pointing out what exactly we know he's given up. He's already agreed to allow some of these kind of arch conservatives, the ones who are gumming up the works, allowing them onto this very powerful committee, the Rules Committee, which is, you know, as you guys know, is usually known as the Speaker's Committee. It's the thing that allows the Speaker to have power because they never get opposed in the Rules Committee. But as it is, it appears that he's going to allow something like four members of this insurgency to be on there, which at the outset means that he has very little power. But the biggest thing is that he has allowed a single member to essentially eject him from the job. If one of the members in his caucus stands up and says, "I want to vacate the chair," Kevin McCarthy's out of a job.
No, and, well, there has to be a vote.
Oh, there has to be a vote. But my point is that that is a sword of Damocles that is hanging over his head. And that gives Democrats a lot of options in terms of legislative strategy. And it also puts him in the constant position of having to do over and over again what got him into this mess, which was trying to meet the concessions demanded by a group of people who ultimately care less about the policies than they do about the personal dynamics and I think the style and the full catastrophe of modern American congressional politics.
Evan, it seems like what you're describing is a speaker who, even if he does manage to prevail and become speaker, is functionally speaking politically dead. Jane, do you think that's fair to say? I mean, are we writing his political obituary at this point, regardless of the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also Charlie Sykes, the Republican commentator, who said this is a self-gelding. And I think that is what
we've— It's a more specific operation.
I think what we've been watching. And I think I would argue that some of these concessions having to do with the Rules Committee are in a way even more important, because no legislation makes it to the floor of the House unless the Rules Committee has allowed that to happen. And they make all the rules about whether there can be amendments and how long the debate can last. And what it means is that this small faction of what's been called the Taliban 20 are going to be able to overshadow what happens on the floor of the House of Representatives ongoing beyond this. And even if Kevin McCarthy bows out, and we don't know what will happen with him, but whether he stays or he leaves, these concessions are likely to bind whoever takes over the speakership. They have now absolutely guaranteed, I think, chaos moving forward.
Absolutely, Jane. Let's talk about January 6th. We're having this conversation on the second anniversary of the insurrection at the Capitol. In some ways, it seems only a fitting way to observe that horrible anniversary with the insurrectionists and those who cheered them on once again being in uproar. Let's talk about how Kevin McCarthy made a key concession after January 6th and what did it get him?
It's absolutely right. The juxtaposition of these two moments is kind of striking, because in Kevin McCarthy's case, when he went along with things like a government shutdown in 2019, or more to the point, when he went along with rehabilitating Donald Trump after January 6th, that was, in a sense, the original sin, because he had put himself now in league with a group of people whose entire self-identity is insurgency. They don't want to actually have a functioning Congress. They want a dysfunctioning Congress. If you were going to pick one moment, it's right after January 6th. We now know from these leaked audio tapes that he believed that Donald Trump had, in fact, been responsible sort of morally and functionally for what happened. He said, I'm done with this guy, more or less. And then he goes down to Mar-a-Lago and kisses the ring, let's say. And I mean, in a way, that was the moment when he was demonstrating his willingness to do anything to get power.
Yeah. So, Jane, I mean, it's amazing that you have now Donald Trump still endorsing Kevin McCarthy. We can talk about whether he's really doing so in a full-throated way or not. And yet the Trumpists, the most diehard Trumpists in the House, don't seem to be listening to him. People like Matt Gaetz, who owe their entire national profile to their slavish sucking up to Donald Trump. And now you have Matt Gaetz, who's basically not listening to Donald Trump. What's going on with
They've
him?
Gone even beyond Trump. I mean, I saw James Carville was saying about Trump that he's what they call in Louisiana a gone pecan. he's seeming... you know, as if the emperor's clothes, if they may not be gone, but they're dropping. They had a little bit of a de-pantsing. And Trumpism has spawned of a group of politicians who are only about their own brands, only about getting attention. They raise money online by raising outrage. And it's this circle of people who, like Matt Gaetz, really, I think he is a prime example of this, who are really just trolls. They're there to troll everybody else, create chaos, get attention, and get famous.
The political scene will be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So let's talk about this group. You called them the Taliban. They've been called the Chaos Caucus.
Tora Bora 20. I mean, they're really dug into the ground. And it's going to be hard to get them out.
Crazy Town is the label that John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, who was sort of their archenemy number one, even predating the Trump era. That's the label that he gave it in his very entertaining and I think very on point memoir called On the House. I want to play a clip right now, which I think really sums up this group of people very nicely.
It wasn't about any so-called principles. It was about chaos. But it was chaos that developed into a predictable pattern. The far-right knuckleheads would refuse to back the House leadership no matter what. But because they were insurgents, they never had the responsibility of trying to actually fix things themselves. So they got to burn it all down and screw up the legislative process, which of course allowed them to continue to complain loudly about how Washington's spending problem never got solved. That kept their favorite straw man alive to take more hits. And every time they punched him, they got another invitation to go on Fox News or on talk radio, or they got another check from their friends in outside groups like the Mintz Outfit. It was their own little private stimulus plan.
That's actually John Boehner himself, by the way, reading his own audiobook. And I all week long, I've been sort of contemplating this idea of like John Boehner and Paul Ryan, his successor, who also eventually basically threw up his hands and quit Congress rather than deal with this wing of the party and Donald Trump as well in Paul Ryan's case. You know, I have this image of the two of them, you know, kicking back over a glass of John Boehner's beloved Merlot and saying, thank God it's not us, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's something too about hearing his kind of smoke-cured voice. There's just like, it's like he's a voice from the kind of crypt of Congress past where, you know, like this is this that was the Congress where they were actually, it was like smoke-filled rooms, and that's, you would break these, make these deals among each other. You can't make a deal with some of these folks because that's contrary to their brand.
But can you know, I remember something that happened in when Boehner was facing this crowd and a government shutdown, and it was that at its worst, when it really looked like it might tank the economy, he flew to New York, and who did he meet with to try to get help? It was David Koch.
Mm-hmm.
And it, as in that quote, he mentions Jim DeMint and his money. But what you're talking about with David Koch also is the outside billionaires who are far right radical billionaires who are funding this kind of obstructionism. And it works for those guys because what they want is to make sure that government doesn't regulate them and doesn't tax them. And Boehner had to go up to New York and beg Koch to try to call off the dogs, basically. And Koch played ball with him. And I don't know whether that would, I doubt that would happen with Jim DeMint, because Jim DeMint is embedded now in this establishment of outside money that is funding this kind of radical obstructionism.
Well, and that's what's very interesting to me, though, is are we at the point, though, where the nihilism has taken over everything and that there are fewer and fewer levers of power to really influence these folks? I mean, what's striking to me is that there doesn't seem to be anyone in charge anymore anywhere, and that, in fact, it's such a group of performative nihilists that there are no one left to make a deal, and that there are no power brokers in the conventional sense of the word anymore. I mean, that's the biggest difference from what I recall as a young reporter on Capitol Hill, even in the beginning of the Newt Gingrich era. And by the way, I noticed a lot of people blame Gingrich for the beginning of this, you know, kind of performative chaos on Capitol Hill, obstructionism as a way of life. Gingrich was a particularly skilled tactician of that. But I would note that Gingrich is furious with these folks. In fact, even posted a blog post the other day calling them the 20 destructive disruptors.
What an irony, really.
I know, right?
I mean, but this is the thing we have watched as this group has gone further and further out towards the cliff, if not over the cliff. And each successive group from before says, oh, they've gone too far. But each one has pushed it further and further towards this.
You know, the revolution eats its own,
totally,
guys.
Totally. I mean, this is one thing I've learned from, you know, living in countries that have been defined by revolutions, is that you can never be revolutionary enough because there is always somebody, a spawn of your own movement, who's going to come and ultimately call you the establishment. And there was this moment, you know, Gingrich, if you want to sort of pick one of these moments that started all this, you could go back to 1978. Gingrich gave this kind of fateful address to the college Republicans in which he said, one of the great problems we have in the Republican Party is that we don't encourage you to be nasty. He said, we encourage you to be neat, obedient, loyal, and faithful, and all these Boy Scout words, which would be great around the campfire, but are lousy in politics. Well, Newt, you got what you wanted.
The Boy Scouts are definitely not in charge anymore. But Jane, I do want to come back because I think it's really important. This question about what role does the hidden hand of money play anymore in a Republican Party that's so defined by addiction to publicity, television, social media? And these guys seem to feel that they can raise their own money. What's interesting is that part of Kevin McCarthy's miscalculation here seemed to be that he was playing by the rules as he understood them, right? He went around the country, he raised hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, the sums involved here are breathtaking. I saw an analysis the other day that showed that the PAC associated with McCarthy had given to 17 of the 20 no McCarthy votes in the course of their election campaigns. And yet they seemed perfectly willing to thumb their noses at McCarthy, despite the fact that he was contributing large sums of money to their election campaigns. So what do you make of that? Did McCarthy just misunderstand how it works?
No, this is really part of I think, a much larger trend. And I think you always, I hate to say it, have to follow the money. And what's happened is that since Citizens United, and even before, the role of the party has been diminished. And what's happened is the big money is coming from outside of the party, from independent groups that are, basically dominated by very radical, very partisan interests, and they are the ones that are throwing their weight around. So we've seen, even if Kevin McCarthy is raising all of this money, there's even more money coming from outside groups. In so many campaigns, the outside spending overwhelms what the candidates themselves spend at this point. And I thought this was an extraordinary moment that didn't get enough attention this week, which was that when McCarthy was trying to negotiate with the, whatever you want to call them, the Taliban 20, who was it who actually was in the back room behind closed doors? It was a representative of an outside dark money group called the Club for Growth. And who are they? Are they little populists? No. You could barely find a group that has more billionaires per square inch than the Club for Growth. Well, among their major funders is Richard Uihlein. There's someone named Jeffrey Yass. There's Robert Mercer, a hedge funder. There's Peter Thiel, has been a big funder in the past, you know, of Facebook, PayPal, Palantir. John W. Childs, who is in private equity. Paul Singer, another huge hedge fund operator. These are the people who are inside the back room wheeling and dealing on behalf of the supposed populists, raising their demands with Kevin McCarthy, who gave away whatever he could to them, which was, in this case, he promised that his spending pack would not try to knock out the candidates in Republican primaries who the more radical group was funding.
And by the way, we should point out that federal election law suggests you're not supposed to coordinate your actions, between your official campaign and supposedly independent outside groups. So that's,
yeah, I mean, he may be in hot water, and so might be the Club for Growth for doing this, because they were, basically giving away sort of congressional favors in exchange for a money deal.
Well, I think there's already a complaint filed about it. Absolutely. But let's talk about the people, too, the insurgents here, whatever you want to call them, because this is, in the end, also a very Washington story about ambition and power and just, raw deal making. I think that leaves out for me in the fact that the Freedom Caucus itself is divided, right? It's not, again, a principle so much as it is who decided, where the advantage is for them in picking sides. You have two of the most visible of, these extremists on opposite sides of each other, increasingly name-calling and getting nasty and personal. Marjorie Taylor Greene, of all people, she, the QAnon adherent, and Trumpist, is sitting there often as this crazy week is played out, right at the side of Kevin McCarthy. And then you have Lauren Boebert, along with Matt Gaetz, who's been one of the most visible of the never Kevins. What's going on here, Evan? Is it about gaining personal advantage?
Yeah, I think I was listening to Mick Mulvaney the other day, who was the co-founder of the Freedom Caucus, who's kind of looking at what he hath wrought and is like, oh, man, what, because he's now considered a kind of establishment weenie by these guys. And, the story is that when you define the direction of travel as you have to be more revolutionary than anybody before you, that's the only way to succeed. This is in some ways the inevitable destination. And it's very hard to give them anything that will satisfy them in policy terms, because they'll move the goalposts and come up with a new objective. And that leaves you in a very difficult position.
I mean, obstruction has gone from being a tactic to basically being the goal.
An here. Identity.
An identity. But it is really interesting to see Marjorie Taylor Greene, I have to say. And I think, basically what it is within the Freedom Caucus, each is making their own decision about how do I further my self-interest better. She cut a deal. I think probably McCarthy thought he had it in the bag when he cut a deal with her, that this would be all it took. And big surprise, it wasn't, because the others saw maybe they could get a better deal, try to get some committee chairmanship or subcommittee chairmanships by obstructing. And so now they're somewhat split in tactics, But really, do they have any separate beliefs? No, not really.
Can I give you the, I mean, this sounds like an exotic reference, but it's, you know, because I've spent all this time looking at like how the Chinese Communist Party over its life has had these moments of implosion and self-cannibalism. Whenever you start to see a movement that starts to have these really fine-grained distinctions of MAGA versus ultra-MAGA mm-hmm. versus ultra-ultra-MAGA, mm-hmm. that's the sign that it's in this kind of dynamic. And you see it. I mean, whenever you get committees, the subcommittee to challenge the previous
subcommittee. But is it a death spiral?
Not
this is the question I have. Is this a death spiral or is this a promise of even more extremism to come?
This is how parties reinvent and renew themselves. And it's funny that you say that, Evan, about the Chinese Communist Party, because actually I've been thinking all week about the early history of the Bolsheviks. Mm. You know, there's the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. Then there was the left-right grouping. Then there was the alleged rightists and the Bukharinites and the, you know, I mean,
who can forget?
Exactly. This is the story, I think, of all, you know, political movements. The MAGA movement is essentially been in a form of hostile takeover of the Republican Party, at least in Congress, for a long time. And now you have them not only splintering, but seeking to who is going to emerge as a leader, because there's a vacuum. Kevin McCarthy is a weak leader. And part of this is a story about the weakness of the Republican leadership overall. And so there's a vacuum.
Well, of course, that's not surprising, is it? Since they basically, their mantra is they don't believe in government. So why should they be, you know, training strong leaders? They're, you know, generation after generation of these people is trying to tear everything down. I mean, and so they're not going to build up somebody who's a fantastic legislator. They're not going to have the equivalent of a sort of a Nancy Pelosi, because they're really not trying to get anything done. While this is happening in Washington, what we've seen in the last election, in the midterm election in 2022, was that these kinds of ultra, ultra MAGA, to quote Evan, candidates, the most extreme election deniers didn't do well. So while we're watching this faction seemingly take the ultimate power over the House of Representatives, we've seen nationally it's not that popular.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if there's going to be a collision somewhere here.
Well, look, Jane, I think it's a great point, but it's also, it can be overstated to a certain extent, right? You always overlearn the perceived lessons of an election. And the truth is the House of Representatives is a highly gerrymandered and, you know, structurally not really representative body, right? So you have many of these members who are making this decision, the Republicans who are voting, come from highly gerrymandered, deep red districts. And guess what? Election deniers did really well in those districts. And election deniers are a majority of the House Republican Conference in the sense that you had actually two-thirds of the House Republican Conference that voted even back in 2021 on January 6th itself after they reconvened to certify Joe Biden's election. Two-thirds of the House Republican Conference actually voted not to certify Biden's election. And some of the people who were in favor of, you know, sort of regular order have disappeared from the Republican Conference in the subsequent 2 years. So actually, it is not representative of the country's election results as a whole, but representative of what's going on in the deepest red areas and pockets and districts of the country.
No, I think the gerrymandering point's mm-hmm. a great point. But it shows you, though, that this is, as you say, not necessarily representative. And I just think it could be, if they keep this up, this kind of chaos, that they could be cruising for bruising in 2024 in terms of the Republican dominance in the House. I mean, this is not an advertisement for the Republican Party.
Right.
I mean, they can be popular in anywhere but the most red district of red America.
So, Evan, we've hardly used the word Democrats
right,
in our
exactly
conversation today. But to Jane's point, how do you think this does affect both the Democratic congressional prospects in 2024? And overall, what does it do to Joe Biden, who, despite his age and despite his unpopularity in the country at large, seems to be preparing to go ahead and announce a re-election bid?
Well, just in the time that they've been trying to elect Kevin McCarthy speaker, Joe Biden's gotten 15 years older, actually, I think is how long it's taken. But, you know, if you listen to him yesterday, he said this is embarrassing. And he said it a few times. You know, he's talking about in the eyes of the world, and I don't think there's any other way to describe it. I mean, I like to listen to the BBC in moments like this because they describe what's going on here like a kind of, you know, bizarre production by a local theater troupe.
And that's interesting, you're listening to the BBC.
I mean, it's just a kind of useful corrective. And then they cut away to be reminded that there are things going on in the world that are leaving the United States behind. But I think that what's interesting, too, is that the Democrats, let's be honest, they're watching this with some glee. There was actually literally popcorn in some places on the House floor when people were watching this. And yet at the same time, this obviously makes it very easy for them to draw a contrast between this kind of ludicrous sideshow and a party that is, in its description, trying to be earnest and get things done. But it also makes it actually hard to get things done. And so at the end of it, you end up with a lot of Americans who say, I want to throw all the bums out. But no, let's be honest. In the meantime, this is making the Democrats' case for them.
You know, I have to say the word schadenfreude has gotten more traction this week in Washington than on most. So let's close in a way where we began, which is there is no speaker elected, right? So, okay, if it's not going to be Kevin McCarthy, let's just throw a few names out there. Who do we think could be in the end, if not now, at some point, you know, with one vote to vacate the chair, McCarthy might win speaker and then, you know, lose it later in the year. So who else is out there on the Republican side who could eventually emerge to govern this ungovernable House, Jane?
Well, the name that people seem to be talking about right now is Steve Scalise, congressman from Louisiana, and famously was shot during a practice for a congressional baseball game and was very badly wounded, but lived to heal and come back and he seems to be a little more popular with his peers, a little more human. At the same time, his track record is very, very far right. And even he's had some scandalous sort of brushes speaking to a white supremacist group with it. It was really ugly that he apologized for, but it was ugly. He seems to be the name that is on people's lips right now.
You know, one of the things we learned from the Bolshevik history, as Susan was describing, and from these movements, is that typically the person who comes in at a moment like this, if it's not McCarthy, is not long for the job. It's a, you know, they shouldn't settle in too much because the same dynamics chuck them out. But as Jane says, you know, Scalise is sort of one of the people on the short list right now. And I would point out about Scalise that, you know, he's a person of almost— he's distinguished most by his absence of legislative achievement. I mean, the one thing, at one point there was a profile of him in 2018 where he was asked sort of, what are you proud of? And he said things like, you know, I've enjoyed being in leadership. I've obviously shown I want to go up further in the leadership. And he said, and I've helped put together coalitions to pass a full repeal of Obamacare. One of the most ridiculous wastes of time that Congress has spent over and over in the last few years, you know, trying to repeal a fully enacted law. So that's a little window into how he thinks. You know, the other couple of names that I think are important, Jim Jordan, who is also one of the diehards in the Freedom Caucus. He gave what has to be remembered as one of the best damning with faint praise speeches that I've ever seen, where he was theoretically nominating Kevin McCarthy, but somehow managed to also use it as an opportunity
it
to
was
go
like
full oratory.
Perfect All About Eve moment. He was standing there basically saying, you're such a great boss, but I'm about to replace you.
Maybe he's the Leon Trotsky in this scenario. So
how'd that end up? Didn't work out well
exactly,
for Trotsky.
There was an ice pick in there somewhere. I hope that doesn't happen.
I don't know.
Here.
I feel like McCarthy is the one, unfortunately, who has the knives out for him at this point.
There's one other person, which is this guy McHenry, who, you know,
Patrick McHenry.
In the nature of how these things work, often it's the one sitting in the quietly in the row, you know, looking like a country parson, who ends up sticking the shiv or just climbing to the top of the heap. And, you know, McHenry's a guy who he came into Congress, he was very young, he at the time was a kind of firebrand, and that didn't work out for him. And so he chose this other route, and he went the inside game, and he started climbing the greasy pole and eventually got his way into the position where he now kind of presents himself as a statesman. He's got silver hair, and, you know, he's somebody who wants to be seen as a contender. So we may be hearing more from him.
I have to say, I like your idea, Evan, about not moving in too fully. And maybe they should keep those bins that are on wheels that have all of the furniture just at least on the wheels, if not in the hallway, you know, because you're right. I think this is going to be a really tricky job for anybody at this
point.
Well,
and speaking of climbing the greasy pole, we should also probably mention Elise Stefanik,
yes,
who literally climbed over Liz Cheney, still warm, to become the Republican conference chair. She is hyper ambitious, was willing to reinvent herself from a Republican more or less moderate to one of the most vociferous of the Trumpers. We'll see where she ends up when this is all over. And we'll see whether Kevin McCarthy stays in the very, very nice suite of offices dedicated to the Speaker of the House that he somewhat presumptuously moved his stuff into starting last weekend.
I would make a wager that
I know it's a dangerous thing to do, that if not at the end of this year, at least at the end of a couple years, he will have an even nicer suite in some lobbyist's office where he's going to be making a lot of money.
All right. Well, you heard it here, folks. Jane, with the prediction, a dangerous thing to do. But nonetheless, I think we've all been absolutely transfixed by the spectacle that has become the U.S. Congress this week in Washington. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Susan Glasser, with my colleagues Jane Mayer and Evan Osnos. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia, Chelsea Daniel, and Jennifer Nolson. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.